Climate change is perhaps the defining event of our times. The impact of human activities on the planet's temperature is leading to the extinction of animal species, the disappearance of coastal regions, and potentially whole countries. Mass migration, triggered by droughts, floods, and unpredictable weather around the world, is also not far on the horizon. In response to this impending doom, the solutions proposed are twofold: mitigating our impact on the planet by cutting down on our fossil fuel consumption, and adapting to this new environment we've created, putting our faith in technologies that might help prevent the disasters predicted. But what if we've been thinking about climate change the wrong way? What if it's not a problem that can be solved, but something that can only be managed? What if climate change is here to stay? Welcome to The Philosopher and the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. This week, we kick off our mini-series on climate change with Tom Brooks, author of Climate Change Ethics for an Endangered World. As you will hear, Tom started out his philosophical career as an aspiring Hegel scholar, but went on to become a philosopher engaged with public policy and the law. He is Professor of Law and Government at the University of Durham and the outgoing Dean of the Durham Law School. He is a public policy advisor and the founding director of the Labour Academic Network. Tom has a lot of time for political philosophers thinking about climate change, but he believes they all suffer from a flawed framework, thinking there is a way climate change can be solved once and for all with this or that policy proposal, rather than something that is beyond our complete control. Tom Brooks, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here and good to see you again.
Very good to see you again, too. So, Tom, I first met you through the Hegel Society of Great Britain when I organized a conference for the society many years ago, and you helped me in that process because you had been the designated organizer for many years. So how did you move from Hegel scholarship to thinking about philosophical questions more tied to public policy, the law, like things like immigration, and more recently climate change?
Well, those are very happy days, and it's good to see you. As I say again, after all those times when I was a young, somewhat impressionable wannabe Hegel scholar, I'm happy to be directly quoted on that. It was kind of a great joy to me that people in that particular society, those philosophers who were engaged in that, Robert Stern, Stephen Holgate, chief amongst a great many others. We're just enormously supportive of young people like the two of us and many others, and gave me opportunities. You know, people come to different philosophers, different philosophical issues for different reasons. Part of the way I got interested in Hegel and philosophy more generally was through British idealists, through, you know, late Victorian British thoughts, where taking these great ideas of system builders and other things, and then trying to put a lot of this into practice. So instead of, you know, getting overly excited about Hegel's latest thoughts on logic and metaphysics and other things like that, as fascinating as those areas can be, they were far more interested in how do we create a world in which I feel at home in the social world? What does that look like? Hegel gives a bit of direction, but doesn't kind of lay out enough specifics. And the thought is of T.H. Green, Bosanquet, many others, Collingwood. But they each grappled with these issues about how a philosopher could speak to public policy, speak to legal issues, and took an active interest in this. And that's something where I find inspiration and a degree of perspiration. So that was kind of led me down my way. Making sense of my world is what the Hegelian project is all about, and that's what drew me in to some of these issues.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, in the trailer of this podcast, I use Hegel's quote about how, you know, philosophy is a way of, you know, thinking about one's times and making sense of one's own time. And often academic philosophy gets a little bit lost in that project. And you know, it's good to be able to find ways to bring it back.
Absolutely. Anyway, if we're talking about the world, then the world matters. These things should connect.
But let me start with a provocative question and one we might circle back to. What does political philosophy really have to contribute to something like the climate change debate? Shouldn't politicians just, you know, follow the science, as the slogan goes these days?
Yes, and the slogan certainly does. I mean, I suppose the way I'd answer this is thinking about how I came to this particular topic of climate change. While I detail in the book early on and say I think preface about how various events relating to climate change and flooding have had an impact on me as a young child. So there's been, climate change has been an interest of mine for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Just a scholarly thing. The reason it got on my scholarly table was actually through coordinating a number of seminars, particularly when I was at Newcastle University, where the speakers were invited to speak about anything they wanted. And one of the hot topics, you know, then and still now, are political philosophers of various descriptions, you know, writing about their solutions to climate change. And I found myself, for each of these papers, you know, kind of learning as I go along from some of the great people, many of whom I write about in the book, seeing the same types of objections about, you've got a, you know, fine proposal, it leads us in the right direction, all this stuff, but does it really bring us to the promised land? That you offer, and kind of raising some doubts about this, not from the perspective of someone who is a skeptic about the science, mm-hmm. I'm not from the position of someone who thinks we shouldn't do something. I think we should do more, not less. But at the same time, not a true believer, as it were, in any slogans when it came to the climate change debate. So it's kind of holding a lens up to what political philosophers themselves were saying about this, trying to hold them up to their own lights was what something that interested me. And yes, we should follow the science. The science is hugely important, but the science doesn't always necessarily lead in only one policy direction. Mm. There's multiple things to do. And so once you have the science, you know, what choices can we make? And philosophers, I think, can be helpful in thinking about the big picture.
Yeah. So as with the pandemic, the science alone doesn't necessarily give you a policy direction. There are lots of other things to consider, like the impacts of various policies on, you know, justice and equality and other sort of political values that come into play. And you need to kind of think through those, I guess, is the idea.
Yeah, the old line about advisors advise, politicians decide.
Before we get into the specifics of your book, Climate Change Ethics for an Endangered World, and the very specific kind of framework that you approach climate change through, I wanted to just get your thoughts on another kind of prevalent thought in the debate around climate change, which is often aired by, you know, famous activists like Greta Thunberg, which is, you know, if only the politicians listened, if only they acted more decisively, then climate change would be solved. So in other words, solving climate change is a problem of political will. You disagree, I think, with that. Why is that?
Yeah, I disagree with that. I mean, the main disagreement I have with that view is the idea that it can be solved. I take the point. I think there's a general point that there is a lot to be done, and that that there's certainly a lot of popular support for green measures and doing more in this area. So there's no issue around the public not being so keen. I think the public is very keen to do something. There also seems to be some good reasons, say, for the economy and skills in terms of kind of creating a green economy and various industrial policy and things that can benefit from going kind of green a bit more head first than we currently are, but I think, you know, there's this kind of notion about being able to solve things once and forever. If only we had the will. If only we had some magic bullet that would kind of address this this wider issue. And that's something where, based on the science, that I'm very skeptical about as a possibility. So I agree with Greta Thunberg, and I do talk favorably about, you know, various comments that she says, I think, in the beginning and the end of the book. The general sentiment I fully support by her and the many other campaigners of Extinction Rebellion, about the need to do more, that the political leaders need to lead from the front, and so on and so forth. I also accept the view of many in that same movement, that the action shouldn't only be top-down, that we should be leading from the bottom up as well. So I have a kind of a different direction, but I am against the view of the silver, you know, magic bullet that will kind of make things go away. I don't think that this is a problem that won't necessarily go away. Perhaps some say like COVID. I don't know. I'm not a medical pandemic specialist at all. Is it something to live with and manage or not? It might be, and that changes then the way we think about what we do next. And how we think about what we do next is something that philosophers can contribute to.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get to the sort of detail of that framework of yours, which is that we've been basically thinking are thinking about climate change the wrong way. And you think the way we usually approach climate change is in terms of what you call end state solutions. So the idea seems to be something like, well, if only we found either the right technology, or if only we reduced our emissions by enough, then climate change would be solved and it would be sort of the end of that. So you've already said a little bit about why you might think that's the wrong way to think about climate change. But can you say a little bit more about this particular framework of end state solutions and how we usually apply it to climate change?
Yeah, it's maybe an unusual phrase or concept. It's one that I take from Robert Nozick, who isn't normally associated with the climate change debate. And in thinking about end state solution, I'm talking about an assumption that I think that folks should not have, that I'm criticizing. The assumption that there is an end state that is possible, that if only we reduce our emissions to a certain level, we will reach an end state. We will reach a new status quo where we can drive a car of a certain kind, or we can live in homes way in a certain way, a certain distance, you know, coastal erosion, other things won't be a problem. They won't feature in if only we made a certain type of leap, or if only we had certain technology. There'll be an end state. We'll be in a forever land where climate change problems, or the threats of climate change, just won't be on the horizon. If we can make this leap, get to that end state and stay there. Mm. I see a lot of political philosophers, about all of them, making some interesting contributions that I find enormously impressive. And to some degree, I sign up to all of them. My main objection is, are they, you know, on their own? Do they get us to a promised land? Answer, no, they don't.
So it's almost like to use a phrase from a different context that maybe isn't appropriate in this one, but the idea is almost like there is no final solution, as it were, to climate change, right? There's no like, okay, if only we do this, then it's done and it's finished. So is that the main idea, that we can get to a place and then once we're there, it's all over, we can kind of
live
happily ever after? It's thinking about it in a more dynamic way, or you're suggesting of thinking about climate change in a lot more dynamic mm-hmm. way, both in terms, I mean, to use the Nozick metaphor a little bit, of how we got here, right? What made us arrive at this place and what happened in the past that brought us to where we are, and think of that as part of the solution, but also think of it in terms of the future, that the future is going to be a lot more dynamic and not a sort of a steady state.
No, that's said better than I do. That's absolutely right. This kind of more dynamic framework is what I have in mind. And, you know, going through different proposals, mm-hmm. which you might want to go through.
We're going to go into in a minute, yeah.
That they each, as I understand them, presents a roadmap to the future. And they each, and the attraction, and you know, what's really drawn a lot of political philosophers to these ideas in an age where, certainly in British universities and many others, you have this kind of real push for impact of your research. You know, how do you, influencing policymakers, This has been seen as a kind of a gold mine for political philosophers to think big about what kinds of concepts or ideas, some principles, that if only our governments followed this plan, then it would lead to this end state, lead to this kind of status quo, you say final solution, thing, and then that will be it, that will be fine. And then the contest between people is, you know, which idea we take. They fight about which of these is the way to get us to basically the same place. I think they get this wrong.
You think there is no such place? Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's no such place.
So let's start from, the two sides, as it were, of this end solutions framework approach that political philosophers usually take. One side offers solution that focus on mitigation, and the other side offers solution of adaptation. And we'll say more about what those two things are. But let's start with mitigation. So as far as I understand it, solutions that focus on that have to do with focusing our efforts on mitigating the effect that we have on climate change as human beings. So the obvious question is, well, what's wrong with that?
Nothing. Nothing is wrong with mitigating. And here you've got several different ideas here presented as solutions. One of the models is thinking about living within a certain footprint, living within a certain limit, the ecological footprint idea. The other is...
Can you say a little bit what that is? I'm sure most people will be familiar, but let's just refresh our memories.
No, of course, I make no assumptions about this. So the idea is something like this, having some carbon emissions on the planet is itself mm-hmm. not a problem. I'm presenting a view held by these figures in a way I think that they would readily recognize. So having a car driving around is itself not a problem per se. The problem is when there's too much emissions, that there's a limit to what's called the carrying capacity of the atmosphere, which also includes the oceans, in the amount of carbon that can safely be stored and managed, as it were, without affecting the temperature, without affecting the arc of atmospheric conditions and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so the big idea is that there's a limit to how much can be safely absorbed, that there is a set bar. You can carve this atmospheric sink, the amount it can safely absorb, by the number of people. And then this is a useful device. They call it the ecological footprint, or sometimes environmental footprint. Usually looking at carbon emissions, sometimes people have other models looking at methane, other things. And you can then say, right, the average person in Britain or America or China uses more or less of this footprint, either way beyond what this is, which is supposed to be a sign that if everyone was doing this, then we're really on a road to ruin. We're going way beyond what the planet can absorb. And then others who are below that, that they are leading more sustainable lives. And so there is a useful, I do find the measure useful in giving us something to think about in terms of use and emissions and impact. And it's often used thinking about people per capita in different countries. So where do countries rate in terms of the ecological footprints?
Since you mentioned Kant before, it's almost this kind of Kantian principle, right? That if everyone polluted the same amount as you, it should still be sustainable in some way, right? So it's a universalizing of that kind of, everyone has their, quota of carbon footprint and you shouldn't exceed it. And you try and somehow make it fair so that everyone's sort of carbon footprint is more or less the same, so that it isn't that some people pollute a lot more than others and so on. Is that the idea?
Absolutely right. I mean, it is a kind of a, I'm happy, since I'm not a Kantian and I'm criticizing the view, I'm very happy to label it a neo-Kantian contribution, therefore bad, or problematic to some degree. Right. What's wrong with moral law as well? Don't get me started. But I think, so the attraction for people, the reason why, I don't want to make a straw person of this. The attraction of this is to say, look, the Earth does have, at a given point, does seem to have a limit to what can be absorbed. you do have people in different countries that are going in an unsustainable direction. Not up for debate. You can measure this. You can have a kind of a map for this, you know, judging country by country where folks are going. And I think that's also right, too. Mm-hmm. And then in having kind of this footprint idea, it's supposed to kind of say, well, when you measure that some are way above it, like in my native United States, and others are way below it, say in places like China, mm-hmm. this is supposed to show us that, this degree of unfairness. And that if only we lived within mm-hmm. the same footprint, that's supposed to be assigned to something that's more fair and more equal.
So what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that idea?
Well, exactly. Well, that's what I'm saying. Well, what's so bad? You know, what's so wrong with being fair and equal? And nothing if being fair and equal could be done in the same way and on the same terms. The problems are multiple. And I use a range of examples, but just for the, you know, one of the first that immediately springs to mind, you know, the energy resource needs of someone living in the northern regions of Norway is different from someone living along the Mediterranean mm-hmm. Sea. This doesn't make one better than the other or want anybody worse. It's just to say that that the extremes of weather and what will be required to stay warm and so on and so forth will be different from one region to the other. Or places in the mountains, Boulder, Colorado, will be, you know, an environmentally conscious place. Their resource needs will be different in the state next door where I used to live, Scottsdale, Arizona, for example, as another thing as well. So that's what it means to live in these areas will require different resource needs. And to say, well, to be, we should all hold each other to the same footprint, I think denies that there are different needs that are, you know, if you're going to have it fair from place to place.
Mm. So I understand that if we want to make everyone's footprint exactly equal, but isn't there a way of adapting the model, as it were, to say that take into consideration, for example, the fact that, you know, people in certain countries need to use heating to stay warm in the winter, whereas others don't. But that still doesn't mean that, you know, maybe they can drive their car around however much they like just because they live in a colder climate, and we still need to place some restrictions on their behavior, or still think that there is, as it were, a limit to the footprint that is proportional to their needs.
I think that's probably right. The problem is that in most of, if not everything I've seen from defenders of this view, the countries that say for this example, I mean, there's also problems of extremes of heat as well. But the extremes yeah. of cold are often in countries that are in the north, global north, and the more affluent countries. And there is this kind of view that they should not be doing less or have any corners cut because of where they are, but that they've got the means to do things and they should be, not looking for any excuse to be anywhere close to where their footprint is.
Right.
So I think that's right, you know, that we should kind of take into consideration this. Also, probably taking an abstract view of this, you know, perhaps we should kind of take a more globally informed view about, well, you know, do folks really need to be in the particular places that they are? But then, you know, the other side of the coin is an argument I've heard from people who do work on group rights, that as, you know, fishing has moved away from certain coastal communities or where they've been different flooding concerns, you know, the argument said, well, why don't they, you know, what's so bad about people moving to drier ground or somewhere else? Can't you just do that as a means of adapting to these changes? Well, folks are losing a way of life that they're mm-hmm. losing because of the excesses of others somewhere else, in many cases, and through no fault of their own. And that seems to be a type of harm. Thinking about arguments like that, I'm a little wary about saying, well, folks who live in extremes of climate should go somewhere that isn't. They should concentrate people in certain bands of certain areas and not other areas, and more extreme adaptation views like that, I'm fully against. So I take your point. I agree that we should maybe, footprint ideas should maybe have some, should maybe adapt to different areas, have different notions of what it means to have a fair slice of the atmospheric sink, right, so to speak. But that's not one that you find. This is meant to be a one size fits all solution to solving the problem. And that's part of the problems it has for me.
Yeah. So a lot of the problems you find with the mitigation approach to climate change does seem to focus not on the principle of mitigation itself, but the specific solutions that come under that umbrella.
Exactly. Right. There's specific solutions that political philosophers put forward.
Yeah. So another solution that is discussed by you and is, you know, a popular kind of idea is this idea that the polluter pays, right? So this idea, I think you have some more perhaps philosophical grounds to object to rather than sort of more pragmatic considerations, namely that this whole principle seems to be premised on the idea that you can somehow compensate other human beings or the environment or maybe even animals when your activities pollute by just sort of paying for it, almost like, you know, paying a shopkeeper for something you knocked over and broke while you were kind of clumsily walking around the store. So as you say, this approach assumes that there's a price for everything, including that, you know, perhaps even for the extinction of certain species. So, okay, there's some obvious things wrong with this approach. What else is problematic about it?
So the polluter pays principle is basically this idea that for $2 or $3 on a barrel of oil, that this will be a disincentive to people consuming oil, emitting carbon into the atmosphere. That would be enough of a disincentive to bring down the global emissions mm-hmm. below a critical level. So one idea that we've just talked about is kind of just hold people within a footprint, whatever that might mean. The other idea is to make it more expensive to drive your cars or produce carbon emissions. And if you can make it suitably more expensive, then people will live within this means. And the folks that you'll be extracting cash from will be the more affluent countries yeah. more often as the bigger polluters. And then the money that's earned from this could be used to pump into kind of correcting some of the damage that's created, noting that a lot of the emissions already in the atmosphere were put there some decades ago, that carbon emissions can be up for decades. Many people who might have polluted might already be dead. And then the issue is, you know, how do you, so, you know, who do we charge for this? You know, how do we, you know, who do we put this burden onto? And, you know, my concerns here, I draw on this distinction that Michael Sandel makes between a fine and a fee. And he uses this in thinking about the polluter pays principle himself. I just echo it. Mm. And the idea is basically, well, look, if polluting is causing a harm and the harm is such that we are faced with the challenge of how do we kind of clean up the mess, charge people extra so we could get some cash to do this. The idea is, well, look, maybe we shouldn't be making a mess in the first place. You know, why are you kind of charging what looks like a fee when really you seem to be wanting to punish people? This seems to be a wrong going on and a wrong that we shouldn't be readily and happily sanctioning. You know, it shouldn't be just that we tax it a bit more and hope people do it a bit less, but we try to do something to make it stop. It's kind of like thinking about, to some degree, how a lot of governments approach smoking. Once upon a time, smoking cigarettes, you know, once upon a time, it was just, we'll just have a so-called sin tax. Mm-hmm. We'll make it a little more expensive than normal for people to light up. But then we'll start putting pictures of yeah. lungs and other things and then, you know, really try to get you to kind of shift your behavior once, you see, you know, that was just really not going far enough. So that's part of the issue. Another part of the issue I have is that when we've seen the petrol prices, gas prices for your non-British audience, we've seen it kind of rise significantly. That didn't lead to any corresponding significant drop in usage of carbon emissions. So that's been a kind of an issue right then and there. So I'm skeptical about whether, you know, adding a few dollars or even several dollars to carbon emissions, is that really going to lead to the planet being under this kind of threshold or not? You know, through the invisible hand of the market, I don't see any evidence for that being being true. That said, you know, it is very popular with politicians. It's probably the idea of theorists that has won the most traction with politicians, but probably just as a means of trying to justify getting having a new tax rather than given the public has been open-minded about climate taxes.
Though it didn't work very well for Emmanuel Macron when he tried to do that.
Not at all.
So there's obviously, and there's obviously a question of justice there as well, because, you know, taxing petrol prices, rising petrol prices affect, you know, perhaps poorer people more drastically than affluent people. And so then there's a question of whether this is a just distribution of the costs.
Absolutely right.
But what you're saying is almost... It doesn't work. People will still drive their cars, just pay a bit more. And also, you know, if you destroy the planet, you can't really like pay someone to fix it. It's not the sort of thing that you could just throw cash at and solve it.
Not everything has a price. And it's not clear what would happen if it did. So if there was the equivalent of making a species extinct, what's the price on that? And if you could put a price on it, so what do you do next? You know, what does that go towards? Museums? Everyone can watch, look at a plaster cast of something that used to be there, if not for the consumption of carbon emissions. It's not quite clear what, even if you could put a number on
really
it, what it would do. No, I don't think it would cut it at all.
Okay, one final proposal that is popular in this kind of mitigation approach is carbon trading. Can you explain what carbon trading is? It's a bit more technical, and what the problem is with it?
Yeah, so it is a bit more technical, but it to some degree borrows from bits of those two approaches we've just spoken to. So on the one hand, it's kind of an idea born of thinking about a footprint, that there's an absolute cap on how much emissions the environment should have. At the same time, also borrows in a way from the Kluter-Pace principle, in that you have certain kind of credits that are bought and sold. And, you know, just like the Kluter-Pace principle, you know, one of the issues is polluters can pollute as much as they can pay. Similarly, you know, one of the issues I have with one of the problems with carbon trading is it doesn't seem to be leading to much improved behavior from the polluting companies that just buy up credits from areas, countries, organizations that aren't going to be polluting that much anyway. So everyone gets a number of credits. My company in a wealthy country emits more than, say, someone else's in the developing world. And I can just kind of live life as normal, but pay a bit of a tax but largely carry on as normal, whereas somewhere in the developing world that's selling me their credits, all right, they benefit materially from having something extra in their pocket and the freedom, I suppose, to do things with that what they want to. And what's wrong with that? Nothing in particular per se. But in terms of the climate, the company that sold me the credits is not doing a whole lot different. Doesn't have to invest in any greener technologies or anything like that. And meanwhile, my company that's pumping waste into the atmosphere, we're kind of carrying on as normal, buying credits from companies that weren't going to pollute, but taking their credits as if they were going to pollute, or would allow them to pollute more. So it's not really kind of really leading to a substantial change. Is it better than doing nothing? Sure, something is better than nothing. I'll happily concede that. But does this lead us to a forever Alice in Wonderland, like, you know, feature land where we don't need to worry about this problem? But if only we had a good carbon trading solution, that would solve it. No, I don't think it would. And so could it be part of a solution? Sure. So could thinking about how we compare country by country in carbon emissions, just as, you know, what's wrong with having polluters pay more for pollution? Nothing at all. Should we have more funds put into, yes, we should. But none of these on their own. Each of them have their champions that say that on their own, carbon trading or environmental footprints or polluter-pays principle, that will do it. I think none will do it on their own. We need some combination of these.
As always, this podcast is created in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal. Check out The Philosopher's website for upcoming events in April, including a webinar with The Philosopher's editor, Anthony Morgan, in conversation with Toby May about his book, A Decent Life, Morality for the Rest of Us. Go to www.thephilosopher1923.org to register for this and many other events for free. We'll come back to a question about what should we do with all these strategies, as it were, in light of abandoning this kind of end state solution framework. But before we get to that, let's focus on the other arm, as it were, of the end solutions way of thinking about the problem, which is adaptation. So I think the idea here is something like, well, we have to deal with the fact that we won't maybe be able to reduce our emissions as much as we'd like. So we have to find alternative technological solutions of managing our emissions somehow. So it's not focused on reducing or mitigating our impact through emissions, but somehow like managing the emissions. And you get a little bit more creative maybe solutions here, like carbon capture and the idea of storing the excess carbon dioxide underground somewhere where no one can see it, or finding ways. This is a solution that sounds quite scary, making the sky a little bit darker so that the temperature of the Earth drops by a little bit. So what's wrong with this kind of approach in your mind?
Yeah, you certainly see some really creative stuff. And I think, to be fair, the adaptation arguments are, I think, every bit as radical, if not more so, some of the mitigation ones. One wonderful contribution called Climatopolis, about kind of moving cities and organizing, you know, structuring the way we have high streets and other things in new ways. There's some kind of seriously creative stuff. Of course, there's been some adaptations put in already. You know, it's not a question of should we have flood defenses in coastal communities under threat. These have existed and will continue to exist. So some of this stuff has already happened. What's also, I think, really good about some of the adaptation views is thinking a bit wider about climate change as well. So a lot of the discussion here, a lot of discussion in my book, a lot of discussion in the literature is thinking about what we're breathing in, thinking about the atmosphere, in terms of the sky, not so much the oceans and not so much the land. Whereas some of the adaptation views rightly will focus on thinking about a huge issue, which is missed by, well, every polluter pays principle person I'm aware of, and many others, which is sanitation. People may not want to think about human waste as populations grow, and thinking about overpopulation, they're thinking about food production. Now, of course, we're thinking about, I mentioned in my book, is just COVID was only just identified right around the time I was putting pen to paper. But, people used to worry a bit about tropical diseases spreading to new areas. Nothing quite like the global pandemic way we have now, at least not for the last few decades in the mainstream. Now it's our everyday life. But thinking about things like sanitation and also some things about the soil are issues relating to climate change that the adaptation people and proponents are very, very good at. And also, and thinking also about the degree to which technology has brought about a lot of benefits. So again, it could be very easy to just say, well, we just need to kind of do less and get the big polluter, the big bad wolf to pay a bit more for trying to kind of blow our house down with climate change related cyclones and so on. But that's the rosy side. The negative side is a lot of this is built on visions of technology that don't yet exist. And what evidence we've seen so far about for example, more efficient insulation in the home has not brought about a stable heating of homes. What has been found is that the average temperature inside our homes, as they become more insulated, the temperature has gone up. As people can more easily afford to heat their homes more, they are. So it's not leading to less emissions, even though they're more emissions friendly or more efficient homes. And also thinking about your uses of technology. Once upon a time, how many electronic devices did we carry around ourselves when we would be traveling to the Hegel Society of Great Britain conference? As for myself, I dare say it'd probably be none. I mean, it might have been a laptop when I had one, but otherwise I just kind of brought, do I admit this on a podcast? Just books and a notepad and a pen. I'm that old fashioned. I'd hope to use the old internet cafe near Teddy Hall. But now, fast forward a couple of decades later, I'm old enough to say this, who doesn't have a laptop now? They were rarer in my day. Now they're not. Mobile phones, other devices are now very, very commonplace, right? And so even though it's become more efficient to create energy, to distribute energy, we're now plugging things on all the time. I have got my device charged most of the day. Enormous amount of energy goes into even sending emails. There's more emails going around now than there ever were. So even though we've had a lot of efficiencies, that's been great. By themselves, these great advances have not led to people making less use of things or living more sustainable lives on average. It's led to people kind of saying, right, if it's cheaper to do this and cheaper to do that, I can more easily afford, having more electronic devices that are fun, that connect me in new ways and do other things, and so on and so forth.
So these are the unintended consequences of technological progress. They solve some problems, but they might end up creating other problems that we hadn't thought about. So, the obvious question is, after sort of looking at the main framework of thinking about climate change solutions and sort of finding all the criticisms that we can bring up, what's the alternative, right? And what would the effect of thinking of climate change not through this end solutions framework actually have on public policy? Would we do anything differently if we thought of climate change more as an unsolvable once and for all problem than we do now?
Mm. No, I think we might. For example, thinking about the pandemic when it started off, there was a lot of folks that were hoping it would kind of, it was here. No making it, no changing that, but then hoping that after a year or so, it might go away. Or that, if only we all, got a jab, that will be the end of it. Just do it once, and boom, silver bullet, it's gone. And it might be, I don't know. I'm not a medical, professional. It might be, I'm having my first jab, in the next few days. That it might be something that, like the flu, will it be more virulent or not? Hopefully it will be less, but it might be something we have to learn to live with. And so the sure. conditions we live now, the changes we have to our life, are not just kind of a once in a moment, once in our lifetime, just do this for a year or so and then get to it, and then we can go back to something. There may not be that.
Mm. And what about in the case of climate change? So if we change our framework and stop thinking about, these kind of silver bullet type solutions that will solve it, how would we go about public policy-wise, political philosophy-wise, thinking about this differently and proposing different kinds of, if not final solutions, temporary or the best solutions that we can actually come up with?
Well, one different way of thinking about it is you have a lot of campaigners saying, look, politicians, if only you did X, we have, a certain amount of time to do X. And once that time is gone, we've got, so many years to save the planet. And that's the pressure on them to make the decision to make certain mitigation or adaptation changes or maybe some combination of the two. And if they do that, then that will solve the problem. And then the focus is that there is a solution to a very big problem. We need to get ourselves in gear. We're in a climate emergency. But it's an emergency where there's a break. We can, we can pull it. And the train will come to a stop. And it'll prevent us from going off a cliff. And we'll be okay. And it's possible. It's in our sight. It's literally in our grasp, like a break might be. And what I think is my proposed different way of thinking about things, of that there isn't an end state, that there isn't a forever after status quo, of a state of permanency to aim for. But instead is that we live in an endangered world. We live in the shadow of catastrophe. And that means that we need to re-theorize what sustainability looks like. So it's not a question of, well, listen, Prime Minister, listen, President, listen, whoever your political leader is, Taoiseach or whoever it is, that you've got 2-5 years, whatever the period of time is, to you know, do something, and you know, before things are too late, before the ocean is another inch or two or meter or 2 meters up, and then we're in trouble. Then we're in trouble. We need to act now to avert being in kind of serious trouble then. I think that the serious trouble is already now. That even if there isn't another 2 degrees, the problems of a climate emergency are going to happen, are can't be ruled out and are very likely, I think. So it's not a question of, we need to act urgently to avert the emergency. We need to act knowing that, to hopefully delay an emergency that's going to happen. There will be some extreme event that will be difficult, if not impossible, to avoid. I think it's inevitable there'll be something. And then rethinking about what that means. So just as with COVID, it may well be what it means is that just as we think about for the NHS, here in the UK, about what is a bad flu season. That people will die of the flu every year that would have not have died if not for the flu in winter. And so there's a vaccination plan in place and other mitigations. But similarly, probably thinking similarly about COVID, that we'll get to a point of there will be COVID deaths as well as flu deaths if current conventional thinking is right. And then thinking about how do we live with that in the shadow of that? This is not going to go away. So these jabs and these and other measures taken in place and hand sanitizer by the door, this isn't something just for now, just getting us through the summer to investing in this, having protections in place and getting used to this and perhaps fluctuations. The disease is not going to stay the same, mutations all over the place like the flu. This is our future and then trying to hit a moving target. Same thing with climate change, hitting a moving target.
Yeah, so let me air an objection to this via someone else who I think, you can tell me whether I'm right about it, had, I think, a similar way of thinking about this. So something you said in a talk about your book was that, we need to basically think of our impact on the planet, knowing that a catastrophe is almost certainly unavoidable. Something terrible is almost certainly going to happen. And this reminded me a little bit of that Jonathan Franzen article in The New Yorker, which, caused a lot of criticism directed both at him and the New Yorker. And the title was entitled, the article was entitled, "What If We Stop Pretending? The Climate Apocalypse is Coming. And to prepare for it, we need to admit that we can't prevent it." So to me, it sounds like what you're saying is a little bit on the same kind of lines. And you can tell me whether I'm right or not about it. But one problem and one criticism, obviously, of that position is that, look, if we're not even doing enough about climate change, thinking that it is an emergency and we can possibly prevent it, and if only we did these things, we wouldn't have to suffer the consequences, wouldn't there be even less of a chance for governments to do anything if they admitted that, well, you know what, we can't actually prevent it. So, bad things are going to happen anyway. So we might as well, not do quite as much given that it's not going to have such a big, big impact. We're no longer preventing a catastrophe. We're just managing a catastrophe. So we might as well, relax a little bit about the whole thing. So what do you say to that?
that's a great objection. I mean, what I've heard a lot from people I've criticized, so as I say, the book is an expansion of an article that was a subject of a special issue a few years ago. I was asked to expand into a book. And the brainchild was just having the same kinds of objections. So hearing people about footprints, adaptation, polluter pays principle, other ideas, and to all of them saying, you know, these are great, and you know, something's better than nothing, and that's the right direction, and all the rest of it. But you know, do you really think this is going to, you know, I just doubt you're going to get to this promised land. And here's, let me lay out objections. And it would usually end up with, well, Tom, don't say that out loud. Don't say out loud that, you know, Pluterpay's principle is imperfect for solving the problem. Because if you do that, if you raise doubts about this plan, however merited the philosophical objection could be, that, you know, it's fine in terms of, you know, we should do less, it's a means of doing less, good. But the argument for it is not that we should kind of do a bit less damage, we should find money somewhere. The argument is we need to kind of break things down significantly so that we don't lead to a proper emergency. I'm just raising the point that I didn't see any reason to think that was plausible. Mm-hmm. And so there was this disconnect between the justification and what they were delivering. Say, well, listen, Tom, don't say that out loud, because politicians are actually listening to this. And if they knew that some of us, mm-hmm. those who believe that there is climate change, you know, like I do, and are on side, if we admit, you know, that things aren't perfect or close to 100%, then we will make politicians say, well, you know, if it's not going to be kind of a one trick, you know, I just do that and that'll solve it with this immediate urgency, and then it'll all go away and I can get on to worrying about other things, then folks will be demotivated to do anything at all and kind of lead to this problem that you raise. So I've heard this in various guises of okay, you know, you raise a good point, but just don't tell anyone you think this, because you'll kind of do harm to the wider cause. I think, first of all, you know, a lot of this trades on being honest about what the problem is and what can be done about it. Mm-hmm. You know, people say this is something to take seriously. I couldn't agree more. They say humans are to blame for the pickle we're in at the moment. You know, I agree. And that human beings have responsibility for doing something about this. You know, absolutely. And we've got various, you know, ways of going about it, and some will be better than others, and all that I sign up to. But just being honest with, you're not going to end this with any of these mm-hmm. things, and just kind of coming clean on this. Now, getting to that point about demotivation, and does it mean that we don't do any, you know, thing? Just kind of give up. It's going to happen anyway, so why do anything mm-hmm. at all?
Yeah, Franzen says in his book, in his article in the New Yorker, says something like, all out war on climate change only makes sense if the war can be won.
And, he's absolutely wrong.
If the war can be won, then like why go all out?
Yeah, why have it? Well, so the reason why I think that I'm not, I'm pessimistic about being able to, you know, win the war, as it were, but I'm not pessimistic about being able to rise to the challenge. And the reason is, I mean, my view is kind of sober, kind of in between the kind of over-optimism I think a lot of political philosophers have had and the, we'll call it resignation, as it were, of that I would ascribe to friends. And
so there is that argument, the argument of honesty, that we need to be honest about the situation. We shouldn't be hiding these facts from, you know, politicians or anyone else. But do you accept that that might nonetheless have an impact on, you know, people's willingness and politicians' willingness to actually act?
I don't. I have a bit of hesitancy. I mean, I take the point that in saying, look, I got a simple solution to a big problem. All we got to do is stop driving cars and then we're fine. And, you know, during the pandemic, a lot of people did stop driving their cars, and maybe that will continue. We're going to find out in the months.
I have my doubts.
Yeah. Months to come. So do I. But in the months to come, we'll all find out. So I can see, you know, the kind of push of, you know, if we only do this, we'll kind of have this kind of, you know, this kind of thing you get your head around, live within a footprint, we'll end this problem of climate change. You can see that it's a big problem, and that can be kind of a good motivation to do stuff. But whereas to say, look, if you really want to kind of lose weight, or if you want to really stop smoking, what you need to do is a kind of a more rigorous over a period of months or maybe for the rest of your life, plan of toning up and a real kind of commitment over a much longer period of time. people might say, wow, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go for the pill. I'm going to take some pills and I'm going to do that solution rather than the more active thing. But I think two things. One is I think that this view is just simply more honest about the state of play, that there isn't the simple solutions. Anyway, I made that point already. The other thing I think is right is that we do have a motivation to doing something. So the thought of well, it's going to happen anyway. Whatever. What difference would it make to significantly reduce carbon emissions, for example? Well, let's count the waves. I mean, if we did reduce emissions to some degree, even if it couldn't prevent forever something, some type of an environmental tragedy happening, what could it do? Well, one, it could lead to the catastrophe not happening as soon as it might otherwise have happened. So if left unabated, if carbon emissions continue to shoot up in the way that they have been, this only makes this kind of emergency happen more quickly rather than less quickly. And so, or so would argue everyone worried about this problem. They want to see this number, see the growth stop. They want to see this the arc go down for fear that the emergency is happening more quickly rather than being pushed off into the future. So in doing something, we make this event on the horizon stay a bit more on the horizon for longer than otherwise would have been. The other thing I think is true is that in kind of going again unabated in this kind of arc going upwards of carbon emissions, not only do we make this terrible event to be avoided happen more quickly than it might have done if we had acted differently, but it might hit us more intensely than it might have otherwise have done. So instead of kind of just having kind of being at a tipping point just and then having to deal with the circumstances there, we might kind of go for, as this thing, as the emissions kind of shoot up and other impacts on the planet happen at this kind of steady pace, there might be a real kind of real rupture, real moment that will make not just the moment hit us kind of unawares and unprepared, but hit us more forcefully than we might have otherwise have done. So in acting to reduce our impact, in acting to do more on the adaptation side, we effectively buy ourselves time to prepare ourselves and adapt ourselves to an event we know is coming on the horizon, and try to make, when it does come, to make it as least painful as possible, and delay its onset as much as possible. That's what I think is the motivation, kind of a realist leveling with people about what the state of play I think genuinely is, but I think there is kind of serious motivation. So we shouldn't be acting in the next year or two to do something to keep sea levels, not rising too high or other types of stuff, and then it'll all be okay. Right now isn't okay. We need to kind of go back from where we are now. And that's not to make something stop in the future. That's to make the future event less terrible. So the motivation should be there. And hopefully, as we've all been coming together, and many people said, could we really change the way we work? Could we really change the way we interact? Well, yes, we can, if we really wanted to. If we really thought it would have some existential impact on us, yes, we can. So I'm optimistic about our being able to do something.
And in that effort to, rather than, stop climate change once and for all, but to, delay it and soften its impact, as it were, would we go about it in any different way from the ways that we are going about it now? So would there be any other strategies that become available or appear once we start thinking of it this way, rather than the end solutions way? So would we be doing anything else other than, mitigation and adaptation and thinking of solutions along those lines?
Well, to on the one hand, to some degree, no. I think, being more conservationist, looking towards technology in tandem, these will both be part of the solution or part of the way forward, but without any final solution, as you say, to to this you know, the no kind of happy ever ending. This, but they'll both be part of it. I think one of the issues, so one of the differences is, instead of thinking of footprints and polluter-based principles and other things as means to avoiding a problem or stopping a problem, that these become parts of a much longer-term strategy, and where I think the room for complacency is much less than wherever it's being drawn with those two. So it's not just a matter of, well, we just need to look at what's sustainable on some measure now, and, you know, looking at what the carrying capacity is now, saying, you know, what that maximum level that the planet can possibly absorb, that's okay, that's fine, and we'll just do that. And I think it's not fine. I think being less than that is you know, and is less as less as possible. It, you know, really should be, there shouldn't be any kind of limit. Maybe an analogy I've not used in the book and not used before, but I'll use with you, is thinking more along the lines of Amartya Sen and capabilities. You know, when it comes to capabilities, there's no kind of limit. There's no kind of safety point. Oh, once we're at this certain point, it's then all right. We can kind of kick our feet up. Hey, look, I'm in my footprint. You know, this is all okay. We just hang out. That's all fine. Oh, we got it at five pounds, a gallon. We're now okay. That'll solve it. And all our emissions are okay. I think that's not right. Ways in which we can reduce, to any degree, are things that we should be looking, to do, because we impact on the planet in some way. And this impact, will have, does have an effect. And so if we're really worried about these future events, then, we should always be, there's no room for complacency of just saying, if only we do X, it'll be all right. We just hang up our boots. There's no hanging up our boots on my view.
So given that you are critical of most people writing on climate change ethics, what would be one book that you would recommend to listeners to read on the topic nonetheless?
Probably the number one book that I would recommend is a debate. It's called Debating Climate Ethics by Oxford University Press in 2016. That would be my favorite book, where you've got, on the one hand, Stephen Gardner, great philosopher at University of Washington, Seattle, who wrote a wonderful book called A Perfect Moral Storm about climate change, and very strong supporter of the mitigation approach, conservation approach, also British national.
We won't hold that against him.
Just get that out there. For I'm waving the flag for Britain right now. You'll forgive me for that. So there you are. But that, in debating David Weisbach, who's a terrific law and economics expert at the University of Chicago Law School, of course, a premier place for law and economics. I noted that the more skeptical folks, the folks a bit more open-minded about adaptation, and to some degree, some curious. There's a wonderful version, reinversion of the polluter pays principle of the is it the paying polluters not to pollute principle. And the argument is, to incentivize Americans and others to not pollute, that the poorer countries ought to pay them to not do so, and that it would be in their interest to do so. And the this is a kind of wonderful back and forth between the two of them. So I think that listeners would probably most benefit from that. It gives both sides of the debate kind of a great interaction, and that's really good. If I could sneak an honorable mention on the list, it would be probably Eric Posner and David Weisbach's Climate Change Justice book. I note that not because I necessarily agree with it, but I think it's one of the more critical and constructive books I've seen on the topic. It takes a very cost-benefit analysis approach, and I'm critical of how far that could really go in something like this. But it's probably, as I say, it's probably the best in opening up one's mind to a new way of thinking about what to do about climate change, but without denying the science, without denying the need to do urgent stuff, without denying human beings have a thing to you know, a place, a part to play, and without denying that there needs to be reductions happening. But then how do you justify that? Who does what? How do you carve out these responsibilities? They go to some, I'll just put it, some very counterintuitive directions that I thought were really great for thinking about this in a new way. But the Gardner and Weisbeck book would be my top.
Tom Brooks, thank you very much.
A great pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
To listen to the rest of the Climate Change series of The Philosopher and the News, subscribe and follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and help spread the word. Share it on social media, tell your friends about it, and leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Next week, I'll be talking to philosopher Alexander Douglas on the Green New Deal and how rethinking our approach to climate change can go hand in hand with rethinking our approach to the economy and jobs. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher and the News. Speak again next week.